Hallo, hallo bei The Curious Radio, der Podcast zum Curious Magazine, wo wir jede Woche am Freitag, also hier im Podcast, in ein neues Thema reinstolpern. Ihr werdet hier von Audiobriefen aus den 1950er Jahren hören, von Kochrezepten aus der Sowjetunion, die bei der bayerischen Oma auftauchen, von Menschen, die, weil sie immer schon davon geträumt haben, über den Atlantik gesegelt sind, ganz ohne Trust Fund, von Menschen, die nach neuen Freundschaften suchen und so weiter und so fort. Mein Name ist Iris und ich bin die Chefredakteurin. Das klingt ziemlich formell, aber ich freue mich jedenfalls, dass ich hier bin und dass ihr hier seid. Und ich freue mich auch, dass uns so viele Menschen schreiben. Auf Instagram oder per Mail zum Beispiel. Regina und Peter und Stefanie, Anna und Katharina und eine andere Stefanie, Diana und oder Diana und JF, Rosie und Cedric, Lotta, Hans und Jacqueline. Der ich noch zurückschreiben muss, also Entschuldigung, Jacqueline. Ich melde mich und ich hoffe, ich habe deinen Namen richtig ausgesprochen. Und es haben sich tatsächlich nämlich auch schon Menschen per WhatsApp gemeldet und das freut uns so ganz besonders. Wir haben nämlich eine Curious Hotline eingerichtet, die ihr per WhatsApp oder Signal erreichen könnt und auf die ihr uns Sprachnachrichten schicken könnt oder auch Fotos oder Textnachrichten. Die Nummer ist, also am besten gleich Handy zücken und einspeichern, die Nummer ist 0043 für Österreich 1397. Okay, nochmal. 0043 für Österreich 676 1337. Und wenn ihr schon am Handy seid, dann hätte ich noch eine Bitte. Und zwar, wir sind ja ganz neu und deshalb kennen uns noch nicht so viele Menschen. Was aber dabei hilft, uns sichtbarer zu machen, ist, wenn ihr in dieser App, die ihr gerade verwendet, um diesen Podcast zu hören, wenn ihr uns dort eine 5-Sterne-Bewertung hinterlässt, also 5 Sternchen, irgendwo ist sie versteckt in der App, manchmal ist es ein bisschen schwierig, das zu finden, aber bitte, bitte nehmt euch kurz die Zeit, um das zu tun, denn das könnte uns tatsächlich weiterhelfen. Oder ihr teilt diesen Podcast mit Menschen, von denen ihr glaubt, dass ihnen dieser Podcast auch gefallen könnte. Auch eine Möglichkeit. Also, so viel dazu, so viel zum Vorspann. Jetzt geht's gleich los, nämlich mit der zweiten Episode zu unserem Hobby-Deep-Dive, dem Birding.
Yeah, I find it kind of weird when people talk about birds' personality. Birds are like much more close to reptiles than they are to mammals, and they don't strike me as very likable. I mean, I like them, you know, obviously I find them very interesting, but I can't relate to a bird.
Das ist Radu und er ist der eigentliche Grund, warum wir beim Curious überhaupt übers Birding reden. Denn er hat mir quasi das Eintrittstor zu diesem Rabbit Hole Birding gezeigt. Denn er ist der Freund einer Freundin, der vor einiger Zeit auf einer Gartenparty einfach aufgetaucht ist und dort über das Extreme Birding gesprochen hat. Das war so neu und so weird für mich, dass ich mehr wissen wollte. Mittlerweile gibt es auch eine YouTube-Doku dazu, die Listers heißt. Also wer die noch nicht gesehen hat, kann die auf YouTube sehen. Und diese Doku, die wird auch in diesem Gespräch vorkommen, denn die zeigt das etwas andere Birding, also das Extreme Birding. Zwei Brüder machen sich dort auf den Weg und sie haben auch am Beginn keine Ahnung vom Birding. Sie machen sich auf den Weg, ein Big Year anzugehen, also ein Jahr, in dem sie so viele Vögel wie nur irgendwie möglich beobachten wollen. Denn das ist auch eine Welt der Birder, Menschen, die Listen machen. Listen von allen Vögeln, die sie in einem Jahr sehen, Listen von Vögeln, die sie in einem Leben sehen und so weiter und so fort. Damit wird das Vögelbeobachten eher zu einem Spiel oder, so kommt es auch in der Doku vor, zu einer Competition, wenn man es eben so extrem betreibt. Und Radu ist da irgendwie mit dabei bei diesem Listing, aber irgendwie auch überhaupt nicht. Und deswegen finde ich, ist er genau die richtige Person, um darüber zu sprechen. Einerseits um die Motivation und um dieses Vögelbeobachten als Spiel und als Quest und andererseits über diese Ambivalenz zur Konkurrenz oder zu diesem Extreme Birding. Und bevor es hier so richtig losgeht, erkläre ich euch noch einen Ausdruck zum Angeben für euch für die nächste Gartenparty. Ein LBG oder LBJ, ein Little Brown Job, ist nämlich eine große Sache für Birders, die auch Listers sind. Denn kleine braune Vögel gibt es ganz, ganz viele. Und wenn man viele Vögel sehen will, dann muss man eben auch diese kleinen braunen Vögel voneinander unterscheiden lernen.
Most people who don't know about birds will see a small brown bird and think it's a small brown bird. It's even called something in birdwatching, it's called an LBJ, like a Lyndon B. Johnson, but it's a little brown job. So it's a bird which is pretty unremarkable in most senses, but these little brown jobs are everywhere and there are lots of different kinds of them.
Und genau so einen kleinen braunen Vogel, der sich hauptsächlich im Gesang von einem anderen kleinen braunen Vogel unterscheidet, den will Radu jetzt gerade, jetzt im Februar oder im Januar finden in Indien. Ich muss ihn kontaktieren, um zu fragen, ob er schon zurück ist. Denn dieser kleine Vogel, den er da finden will, der könnte eine neue Art, also eine neue Spezies sein. Und die erste Person, die einen DNA-Beweis, wie zum Beispiel eine Feder, von diesem neuen kleinen braunen Vogel findet, darf diese Art benennen. Also, ob Radu das schafft, ich halte euch auf dem Laufenden, aber...
It's not really so much about the Lisu Brem Babla. It's like, it's kind of a MacGuffin. It's like a stalking horse.
Ein stalking horse ist ein Vorwand, ein Mittel zum Zweck, ein Mittel für einen anderen Zweck. Und damit höre ich nun auf, hier rein zu quatschen und übergebe an mich selbst und an Radu viel Spaß mit dem Gespräch.
We have to get into this. What is the actual motivation?
Oh, brilliant. I've got this I have prepared for. There's a famous list that's distributed amongst bird watchers called the Seven Joys of Birdwatching. And I have even got it up in another tab. One is the beauty of birds, which is like, yeah, fair enough, they're pretty beautiful. The beauty of being in a natural setting, that's number two. Hunting without killing, great.
Yeah.
Four, the joy of collecting. Five, the joy of puzzle solving. Six, the pleasure of scientific discovery. So, you know, even if it's just for you, it's a new scientific discovery for you. And then the seven one, this is a bit more vague, but it's called the unicorn effect, wherein, you know, you read about a bird, you see a bird in pictures or whatever, and then there comes a moment when you actually see it. You see the real thing in the flesh. That's a very satisfying feeling.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I think I can touch on all of those. The one I find least attractive is number one. But the beauty of birds.
Beauty of birds. But this is what I also wanted to ask you. Because, I mean, I can see a fascination for birds. But do you actually like birds? They're such weird creatures.
Yeah, I find it kind of weird when people talk about birds' personality. Birds are like much more close to reptiles than they are to mammals, and they don't strike me as very likable. I mean, I like them. You know, obviously, I find them very interesting, but I can't relate to a bird. Corvids are a bit different, but like crows and stuff, they have some degree of, you know, self-reflection. They understand themselves, and you can see they have personality a bit more. But most birds, no, they just dart around looking for food.
But they also have such a creepy... I don't know. They're very creepy in and of itself, you know? I don't know. There was like a bird once coming to the office, and it was inside the office. And it was really cute. It was really cute bird. But it freaked me out because of the materiality, like how they move, how they behave is so... I cannot relate to them.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, it's completely true. They move like reptiles. They're very jerky.
Yeah, you feel the
They're
same
not like
way.
Smooth. Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, it's like that's the big reveal, which is like how often I try and get people into birdwatching. I mean, I can say how I got into birdwatching.
Yeah.
We have like two roads in. We have like initially as a small child, where it's different. I mean, when I was like 22-ish. So as a small child, I used to list everything. Like, I used to memorize lists of things. We won't get into necessarily the psychology of this, but I used to love listing. Like, I knew all the cars, I knew all the trees, I knew all the planes, I knew all the trains. I could tell you what, I could identify anything that was within a discrete set. So I could say, that's an Alfa Romeo, that's a Vauxhall, that's a Honda. In the same way, I could say, that's a shoveler duck, that's a Eurasian sparrowhawk. And it kind of was one of these lists. So it meant that when... Throughout my kind of young life, I could ID all the birds for sure. I could tell you, oh, that's this kind of thing. And it stuck. The memory stuck. So that was UK birds only. And then I had this girlfriend when I was in my early 20s. And yeah, she was great. She loved going on these long walks. These long walks in like British countryside for like many hours. And like, I'm quite an outdoorsy person, you know, I like being outdoors, I'm pretty physically fit. but God, it was boring. Like 5 hours in the Peak District and then be like, wow, another incredible view. It's like 5 hours just walking with no sort of purpose to it. But then I sort of noticed, I was like, hold on, that's one of those birds. I've never seen one of those before, but I know it from pictures from when I was a kid. And I thought, okay, I'll get myself a pair of binoculars, see what I can see. And then it took off from there. And then this went on for a while. I moved to Germany. And then I suppose the third big thing was when I started traveling for work. And even moving to Germany, by the way, big thing for me, because continental Europe, you have all kinds of different birds, the UK, like different Spechte, especially. I became very keen on those. But going to different China for my job meant that it's like a whole new set of birds. And then that's when the sort of the world bird watching began for me.
Nice. Yeah. But is it connected to lists?
100%. 100%.
It's
I
like
love
it ticking off something from a list.
Yes, it's less a list than a collection, in the sense that I have a very strong collecting instinct. I loved Pokemon as a child. This is how I try and get my brother into it. I'm like, Tudor, it's just like Pokemon, but it's real, even better. And if I didn't collect birds, I guess I'd collect something else. You know, I'd bankrupt myself if I collected records or if I collected first editions or something. You know, birds are comparatively pretty cheap. But it's absolutely satisfying. Like I have like loads of lists. I'm not a crazy list, so I don't care about like everything. Some people really care about everything, like gulls. Some people even have like lists about, I want to see this gull in every possible plumage. So they change their plumage every half year for like 3 years until they settle on an adult plumage. So maybe we won't do this. This I don't go as far as. But I have different lists. I have like, for example, each family, I'll have a list within that, genuses. I'm very close, for example, to seeing, I think all the European woodpeckers. I've got one more left. No, two more left. And then my big one at the moment is a genus of bird called the laughing thrush. And why would I choose laughing thrush as my weird particular list? It's because I've seen most of the really rare ones already. So I actually could stand to complete the laughing thrush list. And it's an immense satisfaction though from the collection, of course. Huge.
Yeah.
And listing, there's a line which is like, how far we have come from the simple enjoyment of birds. I think that's actually the beginning of the Lister's documentary. And it's true. Sort of. I'm kind of embarrassed to say it. A lot of bird watchers will pretend they're not in it for the listing, but they 100% are. They're lying to themselves because it is incredibly satisfying to collect things and to achieve your collection.
Yeah. And you can always change the parameters of your collections.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like,
there's always something more to do. No, because in other collections, you may achieve something that is complete.
Mm-hmm.
But there, I have the feeling you can, like, you cannot. Because, like you said, you can never see all the birds.
Yeah, people have tried. People have got pretty close. Yeah, there's like a couple of the mega listers have got like 10,000 something odd. There are considered currently by most of the taxonomic systems considered to be about 11,000 birds.
Mm.
People have got like 10,600 or something. But this for me is not tremendously interesting. I also don't count birds I haven't seen. People tend to count birds they've heard. I only count visual ID. So my actual list, which is really, really not that high, it's like sitting at like 550 odd or something, is only birds I've seen. If I did just listening, I'd probably up to like 650. But if you want like juicier stuff, I can on the weird side of it, I will say that birdwatching and these like mega listers are connected to huge amounts of money, like crazy amounts of money.
In which way?
In every way. Like, okay. So on the way back from China for my work, I was able after that, because it's the same part of the world, I thought, okay, on the way back, I'll go to Thailand where I know there's great birdwatching, never been. And I went to this birdwatching lodge. It's relatively inexpensive, actually, but because I was already in that part of the world and I'm given a flight allowance, which is my choice how I use that flight allowance. If I want to take a 48 transfer through Oman to reduce my actual flight cost, I can. So I had some money left over, so I used this to go to Thailand. And I was in this lodge, and there were people there. Like, I'm a pretty good bird watcher. Even in Berlin, like, I'm pretty solid. And the European birds are good, but it's a whole new kind of people. And these people travel for it in a big way. I was talking to one guy, he's a Ukrainian guy living in Bulgaria for the last 10, 15 years old. And he works for Deloitte, of course. And he was talking about European lists, and he was like, I asked him, oh, what bird have you failed to see? Do you never really get to see? Because for me, it's like some quite common birds, like I've just not seen. They've just never happened to show up for me. And he was talking about some stuff. He's like, yeah, well, there's like 25 of these a year in Europe, and I still haven't seen one. I was like, what the hell? It's like, and I was being told a story. He helped me find a bird, actually. He took me out and helped me find a particular owl, the brown babook. But I was talking to him about this, and he was telling me about a guy he'd met in Sri Lanka, who, someone from California, had flown into Sri Lanka to a nature lodge in the forest looking for, he booked a 2-week holiday to find a particularly rare, endemic, that means specific to one place, rare magpie. On the first day he saw it, this 2-week holiday, mm-hmm. he then just cancelled the rest of the holiday and flew back. It's like crazy.
Yeah, right. You can.
And there's a certain irony to the fact that these bird watchers who proclaim to absolutely adore the birds and their natural environments do things like work for Deloitte, which are, you know, I would say probably haven't got their hands entirely clean in the worldwide destruction of birds' environments.
Yeah. I mean, it also, when I now was watching this documentary, I was really conflicted about it, because for the one part, I totally see that kind of this gamification of the whole thing, like hunting without killing something, because that's actually it, right? You hunt for a specific bird, and then you go out places, you mm-hmm. go to the most extreme places, you, I don't know, walk for 3 days, and then you probably find it on the 20th hour that you lay there in the grass or whatever. As I couldn't totally see the fun in that. But at the other side, I was like, oh, I don't know, this everything has to be a competition. It just like, it just drains every fun out of it as well. And the line is so, I didn't see where the line is, because it's so easy. I have the feeling to go from this one place of making it a fun game, like a Pokemon finding game, to go to this extreme of like, oh, I've seen this bird. Check, I fly home. I work for Deloitte. I destroy the environment. But still, I have, I don't know, 750 birds on my list.
I think there is a distinction. I mean, like, the Lister's documentary, which is available on YouTube for anyone who listens to this, and is very good. It talks about this big year, right? This idea to see as many birds as you can within a single year. And specifically within the continental United States. And I think there's a distinction between the sort of a normal lister like me and like these competitive listers. I am not going to be able to compete with these people. Like, I haven't got the money to do it. And I think you can oversaturate for sure. Like, there's another documentary by a Dutch man who sourced me like 6,500 in a year. And he got to the end of this and he was like, actually, you know what, I'm looking forward just to going outside in like, my in Dutch wetlands and being like, oh, that's one of those. For me, it's never really passed into this really instrumental thing. And I can give you an example. This gamification, this is kind of why I say the birds are a kind of stalking horse. I don't know how to say this in German. A MacGuffin is another thing. They're like, it only appears that's what it's about. Actually, it's about something else. I kind of love the research element of it, and I can give you two very nice examples of this. Years and years and years ago, this is the first one. Well, this is one I remember really quite well. I was looking for a Schwarzspecht, a black woodpecker, which doesn't exist in the UK. And when I first arrived in Berlin, I was here for a month or something, and I couldn't find any. I was like going where it should be, etc. I'd seen sightings of it, couldn't find anything. Anyway, I then had to go to Romania, where half my family's from, for a couple of weeks. I forget why, but I was trying to birdwatch. And the thing is, in like on these sites, which I can talk about later, on eBird. In Germany, it's pretty well covered. People, you can see where things are. And in the UK, it's crazy. And in US, it's unbelievable. Like, you can find everyone is, there'll be hundreds of lists happening around you every day. And you can see where things have been seen. But in Romania, there's not. So I did not know where to find this stuff, or where to find a Schwarzspecht near Bucharest. So it goes like this. I look up a Schwarzspecht, I realize it likes old, mature woodland. So it likes mature, deciduous, alluvial woodland, alluvial being near a water source. Mm. I then find water sources next to woodland in Bucharest. Now, obviously, I use Google Maps for this, which, by the way, is an extremely useful tool for birdwatching in this way. I then cannot tell you what's primary forest, i.e. not regenerated, and what's secondary forest. So then I have to use good old archival material. Thank you, university login credentials, to look at Romanian forestry records from, I think it was like the 1910s or so, to find out what was mature oak woodland. So then I tracked this, like, what's what? Then I found a couple patches. I was like, okay, this will be a decent patch. And it also helps, this was near a monastery where they wouldn't traditionally have commercial woodland. So I was in a monastery's grounds. And I went to this place, and on this place, what I'd already done was these calls. So at different times of year, woodpeckers will call differently. Most of the year they won't call, they'll just knock. Now, calling is quite clear, because calling, they have a different song, but a knock, like a click, 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 how are you meant to know? Well, the black woodpecker, Schwarzspecht, knocks about twice as long. So I walked around this area of woodland listening to knock, 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 not long enough, for 4 hours until I heard this long knock. And then I spent half an hour following this long knock very slowly, very quietly, until I got like right at the top of a tree, maybe, I don't know, about 20, 25 meters above me, I saw a Schwarzspecht. And I suppose the birds are sort of just an illusion as to the enjoyment, because for me, it's like, I find it incredibly interesting to learn about all this stuff. Birdwatching gives you, if you do it in the way I do it, or a more serious way, you have to think about, okay, how is the land work? What is the sort of distribution of different biomes and habitats? Why is this heathland? Why do birds like this area? They like it because it's this elevation. So I'm always pretty conscious, for example, of what elevation I'm at. especially when I'm somewhere in the hills or something when I'm traveling. Because sometimes when I've walked down in, for example, Chinese Mountain, I'll notice like four distinct bands as I'm walking down a hill or a mountain in a day. And like the bird song will change completely in these kind of stripes. And it's for me, it's a way of getting very much more sort of tangibly in nature. So I now know, I can now do trees. I can point at what different trees are, because I have to know what trees are there, so if I want to know what birds are going to be there. So yeah, there is this mega list thing, but then there's also the more intense sort of version I do. I also do it with basically no money, which is a lot of these huge mega listers, even in this documentary, they're using guides. They're using local guides who go there every day so they can get served the bird. Someone knows where this particular bird is, and they're like, it'll be nesting here. And you go there, and lo and behold, it is there. It's rubbish. It's like, what's the point?
But maybe then the point is to watch the bird.
Yeah, but birds behave pretty normally. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, some birds are weird.
Because you actually like, don't watch birds. This is what I get now. It's like bird watchers don't watch birds. They go find birds.
I watch some birds. Some birds are weird and I watch them. Like, some birds have really strange behaviors. I've watched in Austria, a Beutelmeiser building its nest. And that's where they build these little, like almost cocoon-like chamber structures. They thread them together from reeds, and they hang them off things. So that's like an unusual behavior that I'm like quite interested in watching. And it's quite nice to watch birds of prey hunt, for example. But like a lot of birds will just jump around on the undergrowth and just like pick at things. It's like, yeah, okay, I kind of know what this bird's about.
Yeah. All right, okay, but how do you get to the point that you want to find this one bird and not another?
Sometimes I just like them. There's sometimes just a bird I'm like, that looks great. I want to see that bird. And sometimes they are beautiful, I will say, but it's kind of the least important of them for me. Sometimes I like, even like how they're named, you know, for example. I like the ones that look weird, things that don't have much relation to other birds. Things that he... Rarities, of course, always nice. Anything that exhibits rare weird behaviours. So, like, special birds. You know, I'm not so keen on gulls, for example. Some people are. Like, I don't even really keep a gull list, to be honest. I just see gull and I think gull, Merva. And it's nice to see. There's a couple of nice gulls, but it doesn't really interest me. For me, it's like, does it do something weird? Does it have a beautiful song? Is it good to look at? Is it rare? Yeah. Is it something which has some kind of... Oh, one thing I do like is when they have like a big cultural importance. Like, I think I'm going to go to Texas next year because my friend wants someone to clear out her grandfather's house. And like, you know, I'll lift boxes up and downstairs in Pennsylvania for 2 weeks if I can tack on, you know, a trip to Texas to see the Roadrunner. Because obviously the Roadrunner cartoon, and I'll be like, I've seen an actual Roadrunner. That's like, that's a good example.
Yeah. It's true. Like when I saw once in my life flamingos flying on the sky, and I had no idea. Like, I am not into birds, and I had no idea that flamingos actually exist in real life because they're such weird creatures that I never imagined them in reality. Like, they live in zoos and they live in pictures, but they don't live in reality in my brain. And then once in Morocco, I saw them on the sky flying, like, I think it was in Tunisia, sorry. But then there was like this big pink bulk of birds in the sky.
Yeah, amazing.
And it was like, I don't know, I can hardly describe what happened to me then. It was so fucking weird.
Yeah, it's like a cartoon. It really is. It's like, these don't belong in real world.
No, totally not.
I'm trying to think of some good European examples of this. Actually, Schwarzspecht is a good example of this. It just looks like a great big cartoon.
How do you find Schwarzspecht?
Go to Old Woodland. Old Woodland with lots of old trees, big trees, so it can, where it can nest, and listen for the call. If you go at like, if you go in autumn or early spring, so just as winters and just as the snowdrops are coming up. So like end of February, beginning of March, they'll be calling, establishing territories. And I'm not going to embarrass myself by doing the call, but it's kind of like a kochi, kochi. And they're very loud. And then you just follow it. But they're great. They're huge. They're like the size of a crow, all black, little red cap, looking like Woody the Woodpecker. Brilliant.
And how do you actually follow the sound? Because you have to understand where the sound is coming from, but it's not easy in the woods to understand where...
That might be kind of like a gestural knowledge. I don't know. That one's weird. That one I'm good at. I've actually got pretty bad eyes. Like, I'm not 20/20 vision. I'm just too vain to wear glasses. But my hearing is good.
You can point into the direction where the sound is coming from.
Yeah. If we connected, I think maybe like started the Zoom call maybe 90 seconds earlier. I didn't see it, but I could have told you at this direction there was a Buntspecht. In a couple of the trees. I didn't see it, but I could hear it. It's like, I think that's just a learned skill. You kind of, the more you associate sight and directionality with sound, the more you're capable of doing it.
And how satisfying is this to actually name birds? Because this is what I thought. Now that I'm thinking about birding, you know, now I go to the forest and I hear birds, which probably I've heard before, but I have no idea. Like, I cannot distinguish. Is this like one bird? Is this like five species? Okay. Is this one? Who knows? Because I don't have any skills in that and I didn't research on it. But then I have the feeling like, okay, it must be really satisfying understanding that the sound that I hear in the forest is like, this is a Buntspecht and this is a whatever. Yeah. I do, like, name those sounds.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I have a bit of a... having spent a lot of time in academia, I do have a little bit of a not resentment, but like irritation with a lot of people, like in seminars talking about nature, we have to connect more with nature. It's like, you don't know anything about nature. Like, this is just like a vague signifier for you. To have, actually have understanding, like people can talk about like, you know, like radical ecologies or something, but not be able to tell me that's a beech tree. And I think it's like a baseline understanding of this stuff is immensely satisfying, especially in spring. In like non-European parts of the world, this is very difficult, or rather like anywhere near the equator, this is horribly hard when you have to like identify everything in a jungle. That's like really hard because the jungle is very dense and very hard to see anything. But in a woodland, like in Wienerwald, I guess, for example, for you, you can, if you get, it doesn't take long to be able to just pick out individual bird sounds and be like sitting in a dawn chorus at like 7 a.m. or something, not even dawn chorus, but an early morning chorus in spring, and hear like a wall of sound, but all of a sudden be like, being able to point and pick out each one and like sort of unthreading the cloth in real time. And a huge help for this was Merlin app, which is super good. There's so much data on this stuff that in Western Europe, you can very reliably identify it with using just your phone, which I don't find actually doesn't ruin it at all for me, because if anything, it's one of the best ways to learn. When I'm in Western Europe, I don't really need to, when I'm in a forest in Western Europe, I don't need this because I know the sounds so much. But if you want to associate, like build the mental connection between the sound and what it is, an app which just tells you initially is a great learning tool. This is actually, if anyone wants to get into bird watching, it's like number one thing I'd say to do is don't worry about eBird so much, because that's actually for people who want a list. Or if you want to find a particular bird, it's useful, sure. But if you just want to know when you're walking for some other reason what a bird is, Merlin in Western Europe, actually indeed in all Europe, frankly, will completely tell you, no problem. And my connection to nature, I feel very calm. I'm a very stressed person, Iris. You know, I'm very neurotic, and actually I find relaxing very hard. I once like tried to like get in a bath with candles and stuff, and this was back when I was in London, and my stoner flatmate suggested I smoke a large joint that would relax me, because everyone could tell I wasn't very relaxed. And I tell you, it did not relax me. It made me feel very, very bad. And that was one of the last times I ever tried to relax, like really in this very relaxed way. But what does relax me is going out and bird watching, because it concentrates you. It completely concentrates you. You have to be attentive to sight and sound and smell even. You know, you can smell water near you, for example. So you can smell rivers. And I think I find it immensely concentrating, which for me is a form of relaxation. If I can just get my head, all the sort of soup of my head can, you know, converge on a straight line towards just paying attention to things. And it's, you know, it's a very big and complicated thing to pay attention to. There's so much going on in it at all times. Yeah.
That's really beautiful. And I can totally relate to it. I don't know. I could see it. I'm just not sure how to start doing this, right? Because it just nature just overwhelms you. If you don't know how to read the signs, you're just there and you're overwhelmed.
If I wanted to get someone into birdwatching from scratch, who knows nothing, let's say, you know, Amsel, you know, Blaumeiser, you know, Kohlmeiser, great, three already. You can already know those. There's probably like in a forest in spring, in Wienerwald, if you're not like a beginner, you can probably get like 20 birds pretty easy. Like really easy, not even just by walking through. And if you have Merlin with you, the app makes it super easy. And then there's like a Kleiber, for example, looks like a Kleiber. It doesn't look like anything else. And a Specht looks like a Specht. Well, it tends to be a Buntspecht. It doesn't really look like anything else. And gradually it's like, I aim in spring in Berlin, I aim for like a 60 bird list in a day. That's like a decent amount, but that's from like being able to distinguish like brown things and being able to tell you like this one has slightly whiter tail feathers and stuff, but for a standard bird, like standard person, it's not so hard to have the initial entry point. Like, yeah, and it's not, and sometimes you can just do it with a lake or something. Lakes are really easy with ducks because ducks, they have the great benefit of not moving very much. And you can just say, this duck looks different to that duck. So if all of a sudden you're doing identification, albeit at a quite simple scale, you're already doing identification. You're noticing visual markers that differ between two things, thus making one thing, and the other thing another thing. And it's just an extension of that process.
Right.
I think I'm always advocating for it, and I think it doesn't develop into an obsession for everyone. Like there's people I know who can now do a few birds because like they've been with me and they've seen like, oh, this bird, that bird, and they're enjoyable for them to just do it on that level.
And probably there's also a difference, you know, because you say like, okay, I'm hunting for one bird and I want to find this one bird. And that, for example, speaks to me completely. Like I would do that. I would be up for that. Like finding a Buntspecht or whatever it is, it could be like a very easy bird for you to find. Mm-hmm. But for me, it would be hard to find one. And I can hear them sometimes, but I never seen one. So let's go find one. That would be really satisfying. Like I can feel the hunt and the enjoyment completely.
This has always been the way I've done it. Even when I was starting out, I was like a kid. Like the rarest thing I ever saw was like a Wintergoldhennchen, I think it is. I actually forget the names in English sometimes. That is a goldcrest in English. That was in my back garden or something. I was like a 7-year-old kid. But now even like when I started again, it took me a long time, for example, to see a kukuk, you know? And I actually went looking for a kukuk. And maybe in this quest for the kukuk in farmland, I might have seen another couple of birds. A meadow pipit or something, but I was looking for the cuckoo, and eventually I did find one. But this whole idea of the quest, I think probably everyone's going to be familiar with David Attenborough, the British naturalist of, and if not, that he is the voice behind every BBC nature documentary. His first program was called Zoo Quest, and the whole idea was they were looking for each episode or series of episodes would be looking for one particular thing. And this was a production technique. They were like, we need to make it more of a quest. And this is very satisfying to people. This is like immensely productive of pathos. It is very narratively satisfying to the hero or heroine aims to do something. And despite adversity, they achieve it. And this is, these kind of like cliches of narrative and cliches of plot work brilliantly. There's a reason why we have these like standard storytelling modes is because they are true.
Let's go back in the end to the list. Because you said, like, how many things were there on the list? Reasons to get into it?
7.
The beauty, okay, we checked like a lot of them. But what is left?
Okay, so we've got beauty of the birds. Yeah, some birds are very gorgeous. I agree. Some are pretty drab. Number 2, the beauty of being in a natural setting. Immensely. Number 3, the joys of hunting without killing. 4, joy of collecting. I also have like, as I said, the lists. Another one I'll give you is like, I have lists for places. So actually my hoof is actually behind us now because I'm sitting on the balcony. And I have a hoof list. I can tell you how many species of bird I've seen in my hoof. It's 9. It's not very many.
That's really cute. Okay, what else is on this list?
We have the joy of puzzle solving, pleasure in making tough IDs, which is not one I have so much. Like people have this one where they use, especially I don't use any camera. I'm actually really against using digital cameras. I don't want to have to use, because there are some bird watchers who, if they don't get a picture of it, get really upset. And like when I take a picture of a bird, I use my phone and I press it against my binoculars in this really crappy setup. And I'm kind of very averse to using like digital SLRs because people use Zoom and stuff, and that kind of kills it for me a bit. It becomes a bit too much techie. I think my puzzle solving is the how can I find this bird without spending thousands of pounds. That's kind of my puzzle. And then the 7th one is the unicorn effect, which is this idea being it's the transition of something from being a kind of theoretical being into being something in the flesh. Like you see a picture of a bird and all of a sudden it pops out at you that it's a real thing. It moves, it has the colors are maybe slightly different to what you'd expect or something. And that is, yeah, you get that. One does actually like, it's amazing to see like, oh my God, it's in 3D.
Yeah. And I think it's also one of the things that I can totally relate to, like in that I got a glimpse of, is that you understand the world, like the natural world around you, that it actually exists, which mm-hmm. is so strange to say. Like we all don't have any clue about nature. But then once we start doing stuff like this, we start to get a clue of nature. Like I, for example, understand now that there are birds in a city, which is so strange that I never thought about those creatures living there. Yeah. Like we're sharing the space, which is so weird because obviously we do. But once you start thinking about it, it becomes 3D. It, like it actually materializes mm-hmm. in front of you. And that's like, I really love this part about it.
Yeah, it's amazing. And like in the cities, I mean, people talk about like, this is a bit of a trend, I guess, in the birdwatching community, this urban birdwatching. But my main list, I keep a world list, which is, I don't really care for like the length of my list. I just keep it. But as you said, I'm all the target birds. But my Berlin list, just within Berlin city limits, is 129 or something. It's like just within the city. And admittedly, like I've kind of fudged it a bit by having like a big farm, which is only just about in Berlin, but still, it's basically within the city. You can get the S-Bahn there. It still counts. It's in zone C, but you're within the city. And it's crazy. Like if you take Americans or Brits, bird watchers to Berlin, in the city, in Tiergarten, there are birds that they are like, wow. There is Goshawk, which is Habicht, which in most places in Europe is extraordinarily rare. They are very shy. And for some peculiar reason, I think actually someone wrote on this in The Guardian maybe about 10 years ago, Berlin has loads of them. And like, you'll see Habicht. You'll like see a Habicht in a graveyard. Pretty much every big graveyard in Berlin will have Habicht. Wiener Friedhof will also, by the way, have a few of them probably. And they're very, very, very rare birds. But they live in the city. I don't know quite why. But it's, yeah, I mean, I don't know whether, has Wien got the Halsbandsittich yet?
The what?
Halsbandsittich.
Halsbandsittich.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These little green parrots.
I don't know.
Ooh. Well, if anyone listening in 5 years, they may well find them because initially in like West German cities, these birds people used to keep as pets. This is like a sort of democratic bird watching experience. Is that everyone's always freaked out when they first see one of these little green parrots in London? In London, they're everywhere, and everyone always freaks out. They're everywhere. They're like they get more common every year because they got released. Basically, they used to be a really common pet, but like they turn out to be really well adapted to Western European cities. These birds actually don't occupy any niche of any European bird, so they actually don't compete with any European bird. So they can just coexist. It is nice. Yeah, they're pretty chill.
Cool. Okay, so let's wait for them. Well, Radu, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
You brought me to places here. Like, we could continue talking, but I have the feeling I've heard so many nice things. And
I love talking about birds. I mean, like people always tell me to stop talking about birds. It's nice to have someone to say, telling someone to tell me to talk more about them. Indeed.
Thank you so much.
Right. All good.